Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 8 of Courage to Thrive, starring Reverend Dr. Robert Flanagan, whose books, Courage to Thrive, as you'll see in the background, help people heal on their journey, which is really fantastic. And if you've listened to our previous or watched our previous episodes, you will hear all about that. Today, you are in for an amazing treat when Bob interviews storyteller and humanitarian Kip Doyle. Today's topic: opening up to life's greatest kindnesses and unlimited possibilities. And when you meet this truly amazing woman today, you will see exactly why that is the perfect title for this show. She is a multi-hyphenate creative force with 15 plus years of experience. She's a storyteller at heart and a humanitarian by calling. Kip travels around the world, capturing the stories of the most vulnerable, migrants, veterans, indigenous communities, and channels them into film, journalism, and advocacy. She is equally at home embedded in the Venezuelan jungle as she is in the boardroom pitching a feature film or filing a patent. Totally amazing. And case in point is you are sitting in your Airstream. So tell us all about that. I'm going to log off and throw it over to Dr. Flanagan. So take it away, Bob.
Thanks, Hope. And welcome, Kip. So great to see you. We've known each other for like ever, and and we won't say how long because we don't want to do that. And so, why don't we start a little bit, like, where are you and what are you up to now, and then we'll move into things. But yeah,
well,
welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for such a kind introduction. My goodness, that was very sweet and generous. And where am I now? Well, yes, Bob, we've known each other way, way, way back. So it's, for me, it's really exciting to see what you're doing, because it's been a long journey for you, and congratulations on all that you've been working on. I love that we're still able to, overlap. And I have four kids. So the four kids, I always try and say, we may come back at places in life, but we're circling upwards and reconnecting when we're all in different places. So I love that. So thank you. I am currently on the southern border, near Tijuana. I'm on the U.S. side, and I am working to try and understand better the situation with the deported veterans. Deported U.S. veterans. And I always want to say it twice, because I feel like the first time it just kind of goes,
right,
and then it takes a second to understand those two words side by side in a sentence. So,
So good. All right. Well, all right. We're going to get into that. And we're going to, I hope we can spend some time really kind of helping people understand just what all that means, because that is when I heard it, I certainly was like, what does this involve? And then when I began to think about it, and I said, how could this be something that's going on in the US? So with that in mind, but let's first start with, and I always like to start with kind of getting a bit of somebody's life story, but really looking at kind of how did you get from point A to point B? I mean, like, how did you get from this place of growing up, high school, college, beginning to have or having your family, and then now you're like totally into some degree, or you've landed in this humanitarian space and this storytelling space. So why don't you talk about kind of how you got from there to here, and like what motivated you on that?
How did you get here?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a good question we all ask ourselves, right?
Yeah.
Somebody once said to me, if you're in your backyard and you're trying to get to the front porch, you might have to go through China.
Yeah.
Like, there are no straight lines.
Yeah.
I suppose high school and then graduate school in journalism and screenwriting, Tisch, NYU, that was my passion, always to capture the stories. And so that sort of teed me up to storytelling and structure and all that. I worked reading the slush pile for George Plimpton at the Paris Review when during college and all, those years. And he was, of course, the greatest gonzo journalist there was. So I used to call him Jorge, and we would, everybody would be looking straight ahead at a situation, and he'd always, be looking at the periphery. So I always say, like, the story, if everybody's, yes, looking in one direction, look down the alleys, that's where an entire world is popping off or something's happening. So the idea of just putting, keeping your eyes open, I guess. As for the dramatic shift or dramatic, I don't know. I mean, I think had the kids, had the family, did all that amazing, raising them, and pretty sure that's the best work I've ever done. But I will say, for me, it just whether I was like heading the school, whatever committees, or it was teeing me up for my next project, which was Compassion Works, trying to teach kids how to track, validate, document community service and volunteerism, creating this app, which, by the way, is something I still think is in need, but it was trying to promote the good, like children in a classroom. So Susie Q's getting straight A's, but Johnny maybe is getting C's. But when the teacher drops her pen, it's Johnny who leans over, picks up the pen, and hands it to the teacher. That's a more interesting person to me. Sorry, I shouldn't judge, but I'd rather that kind of spirit than the straight A, I can answer every question. And I always told my kids, I'm like, you know what, if you got the sportsmanship award, like, you've won. And that always meant a lot to me. And I think that it's just the base of it all. And I think you obviously understand that better than anyone.
Yeah, no, that's great. And that's great. And I think I want to say, having returned to our high school to teach there for 5 years, I want to think that that's the best version of that school. That ultimately, if we could take a school that was really set up for families who could afford a private school and what goes on with that. And maybe the families had an idea that the school was really meant to prepare my, prepare be a prep school, a preparatory school for college, for and but I think I'm hoping a wider casting a wider vision to say maybe that school at its best was preparing people for life, to be the good sportsman in life, to be the caring person in life, to be somebody who is willing to take risk and to take risk in the service of others. That's what I hope. I mean, I don't, I think you certainly embody that. And I guess, and here's the other thing, or the other question I have, kind of question for you at the beginning is, we are at an age where our peers, many of them are looking to retire and kind of, spend their days just really, whatever. I don't know what you would do, playing pickleball and getting, having to get an ACL surgery or whatever, whatever it is, or it's, relaxing in kind of retirement, and here you are far from that. You're arms deep in helping people that are in distress. And so I certainly think that that's lovely, but also kind of what made you, what's made you come up with that decision? You don't have to be doing this rough and tumble stuff that at times you're doing and being this much, in service of people who are really struggling.
Good point, good question, and I love what you say about the the history of the school where it really was about, I mean, a lot of focus on community service, and that stuck with me. Right, I love the notion of like retirement. I think I have a thought that I have this theme of, that runs through when I'm out on the Ducati, and I love that. And it's like ride or rust, and the other is I'm just going to skid into the grave or whatever wherever I go. But I am not. I think it's a really loaded question, specifically for a woman, because you raise your kids and you throw it all, like how many opportunities that you're like, oh my goodness, like I totally forgot that I had this amazing opportunity because I put my brain on the shelf a little bit and I had four kids. Well, I'm thrilled I did. The love of those kids is all that matters to me in my entire life. And but you do that and you get through that, and then you've got, aging parents who are your world. And you drop everything and you're a caregiver. And so that happens. So it's somewhere through all of this, you sit in the pickup line at school and you create a patent, an idea, or you write a book, or you write another book. And you always do it around everything else. And you're juggling that, and it's and so my heart always went out to the women who were on the train terminal, the train platforms, going down to jobs that were high powered back when we were raising kids. And that was just like frowned upon by the women who, I mean, I was at the they were the kids were at the French American school, great school, but there were a lot of women who just could go and go to the city and have lunch. Or there were the women who were working at the schools and engaged in the kids, and then there were the working moms who were just. It was, it was brutal. It was far more brutal than it is today, even though the juggle and the balance is never going to add up to 100%. And so it's taxing, crazy taxing on them. And I always remembered that and thought, be kind, just be kind to these women who are doing so much. But for me, it was really, I just felt like I just began. And I've always felt that way. Like, gosh, I finally. I mean, I hate to sound like that, but you finally come up for air after you've taken care of all of that, and I'm like, okay, now I can like clean the slate and get at it instead of just like working around, like a water going down a stream, it's like you got to work around all those rocks to finally find the ocean or to get at it. And so, yeah, no, the slowing down element, I'll let you know when that happens.
I think
Pickleball. Oh my, pickleball. What is that?
I mean, I just have no interest. But I also am like, I guess I don't see a value in retiring. It's just not, yeah, sure. I don't want to do the grind. I don't want to do the commute into an hour or two in traffic. I don't want to, each way. And I hear about people doing that, and I think, God, how can you do that? I mean, they hopefully throw on our podcast and it helps them get through. But I also think, that those kind of grinds, they wear on you. And so when you have a chance to pull the plug and not do it, people do that. I also think that, so if you can get out from under the grind, how still can you be of service? I mean, that's certainly how I've looked at it, is, and I may not work as hard as I did at some other point in my life, or I think I don't, but I work differently. And I think, that may be even more effective on that. And so I don't think, I kind of think I will fill my days with something called work. Until I skid into the grave, that kind of thing. Yeah, I think that's, and that, and that's a, so we have a similar plan. And I think I was reminded of kind of the early feminist, Betty Friedan, recently. And there was, we were talking about the, she had a phrase that, that or the most often quoted phrase, that's only half of it, but the most often quoted part is you can have it all, right? As Betty Fernandez, to women, you can have it all. Okay. But the part that's left out of that is you can have it all, but not all at the same time. And I think of, and if truly that's her quote, I think that that makes so much sense. And it makes sense in not only for women, but I think it makes sense for anybody. I think the there's a corporate trade-offs that we the trade-offs is that the most driven and highly kind of corporate successful women that I know are tend not to have children or tend to be divorced, and because it's hard to have it's hard particularly for them to have both, or the family is really is in a position where the family is taken care of, by somebody else, whether that's the another spouse or the spouse or caregivers, and I think it's different for men. I think that if the men that are driven to those high echelons are often multiple divorced guys, and so there, I guess what I'm saying is I think on both sides there's a cost to it to that corporate achievement that doesn't get recognized in often in our lives. And so I think you as you talk about going through that stream and around those stones, but I think often, well, life is not a straight line, and life itself will throw obstacles at our way, and it's will we just pay to have somebody else handle those obstacles, or try to ignore them? And I think that ultimately diminishes us. So I think there is that sense of seasons, right, that we can have in life, and we can't all have everything all at once. Is a good way to look at it, I think, ultimately for our own health and our ability to thrive in truly self-thriving. So, well, so
Very
how
good.
did so ha, so let's move a little bit to some of the work you've done, and I think in particular today, focusing on veterans. You certainly have had a care for U.S. military veterans for a while. So why don't we start there? What's that story? How did you get so immersed in caring for these people?
Dad, was a World War II Iwo Jima Marine,
Okay.
and he would I was fortunate enough to ask one question. All of our dads who served, and we never knew anything that generation. But I was urged to, because he was still alive, to put pen to paper, Kip, and ask him a few questions. And so I did. And sort of end of life, I realized Dad described as he was a doctor, and he would say, like, early in life, you thought about war and awful things that happened like 30% of the time, because you're out there raising kids and having your life and doing your job. And but as you get older, the 30 sort of 70%, so it switches from like barely thinking about it to all consuming. And so I caught Dad at the kind of end of life and asked him some questions. I went from hearing his story really for the first time to writing a few notes down to then it got published. And so he was all of a sudden looking at his story going, what is this? So it was in Purple Heart magazine, and I really, and he, it mattered to him, the veteran population. He really had this connection. And I'd take him to the VA up in Maine, and he'd, had a cane, and then all of a sudden his shoulders would go back and he'd walk in and hand me the cane. Entering the VA was unbelievable to witness this transformation. that was going on. And then at the same time, oldest daughter was engaged to a Marine. Stephen, was a wonderful, wonderful kid. He was a great guy who we loved. We all loved. And he had a great VA. When they were in Colorado, they moved. And I think his connection to the VA and to the services sort of came, fell off. And it's what I always say, the isolation, lack of connection, and the demons, whatever they look like, that happened. And so when that happened, and it would happen right around when Dad passed away, and I just said, that's it. I had a nonprofit in place that I creating content, the mission-driven content, and action, call to action and awareness campaigns. That was the sort of the mission of my Global Compassion in Action. And so I started to think of a way that we could do something to stop this in honor of Stephen and my dad, to sort of take a look at the plight of the veteran suicide epidemic. And so I got together with the team, and we did a short film and a PSA with Martin Sheen on the veteran suicide epidemic. And it was really, for me, it was the start. There is a definite trajectory. PSA, short film, first documentary, which is out now, about reintegration from active into civilian life. It's called Personal Courage, and you were very kind in helping us with that one. And now I'm working on two more that are really difficult, really difficult. They are subjects that nobody wants to touch. I started this work, and it's called, well, I don't have a title because I have to be very, what I want to say and what I can say. And at this point, it feels like it doesn't even matter. Because people are really not interested in talking about women in the military. Let's just leave it at that. I'm not only talking about women in the military, but I'm talking about what I wanted to do was do a documentary about men and women together. I thought, oh, I'll do a little of each. And then it was very quickly apparent to me that the story of men in the military is very different than what women go through. And this just kept resurfacing, this theme of military sexual trauma, and which we're now sort of calling military sexual violence, because let's just call it what it is. And it's a story as old as time, and it is not really getting any better. But I started that body of work, and funding dried up because nobody wants to talk about women in the military, and those grants sort of vanished. I mean, it is a really about the worst moment in time that I could be trying to tackle this. And as I was finishing that story, that entire body of work talking about, Operation Fouled Anchor and all of these kind of cover-ups and basically just awful, tracking women who've been through some horrible things. A story broke last June of a young sailor, Latina, Angelina Resendez, who was brutally raped and murdered on her when she was in Virginia Beach, when they were, by a fellow sailor, Jeremiah Copeland. So he, what I sadly believed was, I was finished with this larger body of work. But I was like, man, the doom scrolling and people just, yeah, that's nice. The lack of connection whatsoever to the importance of this, and how on earth is anybody going to care about this subject in this world where it's just about doom scrolling? So I was really determined to finish that film. But it was like, we have one smoking gun, this piece of paper. And I'm like, I hate to say it, but I'm really sorry to say this, but I think it's going to take something really dramatic as an ending to this film. And the day that I said that, and the day that I made that decision to like shelf that because it just wasn't going to capture anybody's attention, was the day that I learned about Angelina Resendez and the brutal, brutal misconduct, injustice. This young, incredible, beautiful young Latina woman, and her mother's fight for justice. She was raped by this young man who has a history since middle school of this activity, and then filming it and then distributing it. I mean, everything. And how he got into the military, how they allowed him, and then the number of people that he continued to abuse while in the military. It was like they just opened the floodgate for this guy.
That's
So
so shocking.
it is shocking. It is, and it's really terrible. But she, I made, as a mom, I made a promise to her mother, who is the most extraordinary woman I honestly have ever met, and she's running for a local political seat out in Texas. She's won the runoff, and she's running on this platform, how to keep your daughter safe in the military, and how did this happen? And I promised her that I would get this film done. So, the details of that are forthcoming. There's a trial in June, but the truth of the matter is, she was killed, and nobody checked on anything. And for 4 days, her body was in a duffel bag in the guy's closet until he dumped the body. 10 days later, they found her, two little boys playing in deep in the woods, and they found her. I mean, and the outrage. Where's the outrage? Where's anything? So that story is a standalone, obviously. That is a true, true crime story. That is not what they call wives with knives. Like, this is really wrong. But the cover up of it, and who's involved, and how it all happened, when, Angie's mom said, I spoke to her multiple times a day, and she kept saying, anyway, we're working on that. But that, of course, will become the ending to the larger body of work, if there's ever a moment when anybody wants to hear about it. And
So
that's
that's so
those two. And
shocking,
then,
and that's so awful, and it's so good that you're pursuing this. And troubles in the military touch close to home to you. I mean, that and that's I mean, that's clear connection there, right? So and you could have, kind of done you could have left it at writing some letters to Congress, or you could have left it at doing some support work around veteran suicides, which you did, right? You did all those videos and the and certainly promoting 22 suicides a day with the U.S. military veterans community, and you could have left it there, but you didn't. I mean, you went so much further in it, and you allowed yourself to kind of be moved just into that, into the story, into the incident, into the human life of that person. Not everybody would do that. Some people would be like, wow, this is too much. I've done enough. And so it is remarkable, that you've moved deeper into this, right? And now you're on the US border, and you're helping service people that have been deported. And so, I mean, so let's move on from, if we can, move on from Angie's story to these folks, and
Angie, I
what
mean,
you're doing
Angie's
there. If
story
Angie
is
isn't enough, right?
no, I mean, I and it's a difficult thing to segue off of, because I really do want to say that, I am relentless, and I am going to shame everyone into listening. I mean, I have been, self-funding this whole project, and I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to stop. And I am going to enlist the leaders in the Latina, foundations, civil rights foundations, and the getting women in film or somebody to understand the importance of this, we're working it. But all that to say, and so the deported veterans, and my final sort of trajectory, as I was talking about after the documentaries and such, is a TV series which is called Radio Check. And Radio Check is a term I got together with a Marine who's sort of the most renowned scout sniper in the history of the Marines, and he really is. And Milo Afong wrote a book about his experience, and I immediately contacted him and I said, "Why did you write this book, Hogs in the Sand?" And he said, "Because I could. Because I was, he had access. He was trained to do stuff that not everybody else was. So, but his attitude was always, if you served, you served. Whether you were a cook, an engineer, a mechanic, or a sniper, you served, darn it, and you own that." Because a lot of times it's like, "Ah, I didn't really do anything, but you served." And so I constantly pause people to remember that they served, right? That you did a lot more than most of us. So the radio check was a term that Milo and his and he introduced me to Chad, and we've been working on this project. It's set in a veteran outreach facility. The phone call comes in, there's a veteran in trouble. And it's this wonderful MASH meets Generation Kill kind of, by veterans, for veterans, of veterans. That's the stories. I want to create a writing table, a writing room for veterans, warrior poets who are using writing as a therapeutic method to kind of get their stories out. The actors who are acting through their trauma, that's another program. Then there are all the veterans who worked on mechanical equipment, who could be like the gaff boy, the best boy, that all of the the production team. And then maybe a director of photographer or somebody who's in that space who could actually film it as a director. The goal is that it's as much of it is by and for the veterans, and the stories connecting older veteran, younger veteran, because that's a connection that needs to be made. And then the us against them of the civilian population versus the veteran population. So it's this raucous military humor, total gallows humor, because what else do you do when you're staring down a barrel, as they used to say? And it's all and the lead character is the pastor. He was in the military and there's this whole spiritual element to it. Native American, going all the way back to sort of the roots of like maybe the oldest Americans to serve, right? The Native American. But in any case, that is that's the ultimate project that I'm working towards and working on. And obviously everything I learned along the way was intense research around, because you can't just tee up a problem and then like, sorry, drop a bomb and run. You kind of need to, in my opinion, or when writing a story, I always like to say, start at the end and then work back into it. And so the end of this is hope, right? If there's no hope, there's no way forward. And so to me, you're talking about stories that come in. There's a veteran in trouble. Radio check is what they would do. They would, if they check, radio check, good comms, bad comms, if they don't hear a response and they're out and, outside the wire, they know something's wrong. And so when they'd get out of the military, Milo and Chad would say they'd just text each other all radio check. And if they don't hear back, something's up. And they're going to go check and do a buddy check on that veteran. And that's where the term came from, and that's what this is all about. So, backing it up with like a website that talks about, hey, you got a story, come on in, join our virtual safety net of other veterans, so that you can kind of create a virtual community where they become a part of versus apart from. So that's the that's sort of the long-term project. There's a group in Chicago that's interested in making it happen. So we really are working towards that.
And how does that relate into deported vet.
So the deported veteran, so every story is at the end of each episode, you have a moment where a real veteran comes on and says, I had a, you know, I had one in the chamber. I was going to take my life. I had suicidal ideations. To me, that lack of hope is you've got to balance that with initiative. So I spent a lot of time last 10 years, researching all of the initiatives of equine therapy, meditation, you know, even the use of the ayahuascas and the, you know, these ketamines, and people are finding healing through that, or, you know, a service dog. There's so many initiatives out there, and this would be an opportunity to sort of sweep a spotlight out over them. And each episode of this TV series is a subject matter. So it's soldiers who salsa, you know, getting your mojo back after you come back. That was one. And then I learned about deported veterans. I last year was up on the border in Nogales working with the migrant crisis down there, and I learned a bit about this group in Tijuana that had founded this bunker. And I was stunned. I thought I knew a thing or two in this space. I mean, I've been, and I was like, deported veterans? What are you talking about? And so that to me, that was the intersection of, you know, the work in South America, or, you know, just the knowledge, a little bit of knowledge about what's going on in Venezuela meets a little bit of knowledge in the veteran space. And then I thought, that's a story that takes us down to another level of just pain when these men and women have served a country, put their sworn on the Bible and on the oath of, you know, to protect the United States of America, and that is their country, only to be sent off when bad things happen. Look, there's no stopgap between the PTS that a American citizen veteran suffers is identical to that of Latino serving as a, you know, in the Marines, whatever. I mean, the same exact trauma. They might get into trouble. You know, you might start drinking or doing drugs or do something that you regret later. But there's some stops like along the way, I think, for a citizen, and those were promised to this to the those who raised their hand. As you know, they were promised citizenship and it wasn't honored when something bad happened. And the stories, yes, people do bad things and lots of bad things happen and trauma is real, but bouncing a check is not, you know, moral turpitude. That is not a life-threatening situation. And those stories sadly are occurring where minor things are triggering the deportation of these veterans who are pillars of their community, and they're Vietnam vets. Like,
That's horrible. And so so I guess on the one hand, here you're once again tackling a really big story here, and like how do you bring that to light, one, but also, it sounds like there's no recourse, so there's no, as you say, stopgap to from bouncing a check to being out of the country. And so, I mean, what would you suggest? I mean, what's the gap? What's the stop that you're not seeing, you think is being missed, just for somebody who has no idea about this?
Yeah, I mean, so that was how I felt. Like, the best part is when you learn something, right? I mean, teachability, right? Willingness to learn, a little bit of humility, and a ton of humility and compassion is, I'm being facetious, but I mean, that to me, that's like courage. When you have all of that and you're willing, being risk adverse is kind of critical, because you really are, like, I mean, not risk averse, you're willing to risk. Those who are risk averse might look away. So when I learned about what Hector Baraja is doing, Hector is the founder of the original bunker in Tijuana. He was deported. He has since been repatriated, and because he was, He came to this country when he was 8. His family, they're in Compton, here in LA, and he acknowledges that he did some stuff, but he has since been repatriated, and now he's fighting with everything he has. It almost took him out. The first bunker was closed after, I mean, he gave everything. On $300, he housed like 12 veterans. He had no idea what he was doing, but he did it. And, in doing so, it almost took him out. He struggles to do the next right thing, right? And he's working on mindfulness, and it's a journey, and it's a really brutal one, because his attitude is there has to be a policy in place that, like, you sign up for this, and while you sign up for it, you get your immunizations, you get like however many shots, but right at the end of that whole process of welcoming you into the United States military, there should be a little box. Check this if you want to make sure that citizenship is secured here and thereafter, whatever, because it's that simple. And these guys, many of them, as I described my dad, right? They're like in the 30% mode. They're raising families, they're working nighttime, they're going to school, they're serving in the reserves or whatever. And they're not thinking about what they promised me. I swore. They promised, that's it. Well, it wasn't the case. And one veteran, he's a Vietnam vet, and he's in Tijuana homeless. And he's like, I came here when I was 3. I'm lucky I speak Spanish. He was deported. He didn't know. They claim that he didn't sign the right papers or this and that. He's like, how the heck was I supposed to know that? So Hector's entire thrust of the petition, the work that he's doing is make it so that it's real and it's documented and it's easy and people are aware of the steps and processes that need to be taken. The deportable offenses, deportable offense. What's a deportable offense? Bouncing a check? I don't think so. Deportable offense, you have a gun and you kill somebody. Okay. Deportable offense. But also, that's not Mexico's responsibility. You throw them over the board. Like they came up through the ranks. Is it a question of our system of justice, don't you think? I mean, it's a really difficult subject, but understanding a deportable offense and a real one versus like, no, we just need to hit our quota. We at Border Patrol need to hit our quota of deportation, and we get a bonus if we deport a few more.
Big stuff. Yeah. A little passionate about it. Yes.
Say, Barry. Yes. Yeah.
And that's important. And I wonder, just to, I mean, I gotta since pause for a minute because it is such a, both those stories are so incredible, and both those situations are so awful, and just difficult to comprehend, and to be like, this is the world we live in. This isn't the world we're told that we live in. This is what's actually happening, and there's always that disconnect between what's the narrative that we're given about our country, and then what are the actions of that, and how we as a country fail people. And fail people all the time in any country. We could look at that in any country, but we kind of have this, the city on the hill type view of our country. And when it doesn't meet that, we can kind of say, well, it's because certain other people aren't acting in a certain way. But this is the country, the institutions that aren't acting right, and it's not. It's and so that falls on all of us when it's like that. It's something we can't just push aside because it erodes the vision of the positive vision of the nation. So, it needs to be addressed. It needs to be looked at, and it's brave and courageous for you to take that mantle on and push forward to it. And so with that in mind, I mean, I think, part of this podcast is not to be, I don't excuse religion in it, but I'm more interested in what we would kind of call just in general kind of spirituality and a spiritual journey. And I wonder, so much of what you're doing is kind of a personal moral cause, and your motivations are so, deep into yourself. And I wonder if what you would, how you would talk about or your own spiritual journey, if you can articulate that for a minute.
I always say it's funny. It's not about me at all. Like, it really isn't. And so when I get so passionate, and it's because I'm trying really hard to listen. I'm trying really hard to understand. And there's a lot of damage. When you see this, we had it. Did a little toy drive for the children the other day, and we went and got them, and we gave out the toys. The children arrived with their mostly their fathers, because they're below deported in Tijuana. But it was like, they were so grateful, and you just see where we're trying to set up this new bunker was, it's up in the barrios, and it's really. It's tough, and yet these smiles, and they have so little, and yet they're so grateful and so generous in giving. One receives so much more, and also those who have the least give the most, and that has always been what what I've witnessed. But it's not about me. It's like, how can we just facilitate connection, or how can we promote, kindness and just the patience to just listen? For me, we had everything. We had a wonderful, wonderful, stable life. I had parents, both doctors, and my brother's a doctor. I mean, it was always about sort of helping in a different way, medically or whatever. But I just I couldn't sit by, and I didn't want to just talk. I created this campaign around the women's film. It's called lipservicebomb.com, and it's about, put your money where your mouth is and stop giving me lip service. And it's just this little lip balm in a dog tin, dog tag tin, and it's going to go to promote like a little tchotchke that, somebody can buy, the kid can buy for mommy and put in her stocking or something. But it's like 100% of the proceeds are going to go to the women in the military, and figuring out programs that could help them. But it's like, it's all based on, just those who talk versus those who do. And I just have never been keen on just stirring the pot, because it's a big pot. And yes, you can't boil the ocean and all those things that I've learned, but you can do something. And when I heard about the deported veterans, I immediately knew that they need to be heard from. So I am spending this time here now just meeting these folks, trying to see if I can help, like, I don't know, build the website with them, and bring food, and bring some clothes, and bring some toys. Just like, who knows? There's no roadmap. There never is. The only thing that you need is willingness. And yeah, when you're down below Tijuana and you think, okay, I'm gonna bounce up, and I'm gonna be able to move around, and then sorry, a civil war sort of kicks off because they kill the wrong guy. Well, they kill the biggest guy and you're trapped down there. That was a little crazy. I didn't anticipate it, obviously. But then it's like, look, I chose to do this. I chose to put myself here. And I would never change that. But I think it's because the people that are, for the most part, a majority of the people are just wonderful, wonderful people who are just trapped in bad places and situations. And whether that's the locals, you know, where I was in Mexico, who are just like, this isn't ideal, or it's the deported veterans who are just struggling with hopelessness.
Wow. One question I haven't asked anybody else, but in the previous episodes, but I feel like I'd have to ask you about it. If there was a younger version of yourself, you know, if there is a young person who's listening to this, what advice would you give? You know, what guidance or what suggestion would you give if somebody's like, wow, you know, I want to be like Kip, you know, I mean, that sense, right? You know, I want to give back to the world. I want to care for the world in this way that you do. You know, what would you say? What would that be like?
That's such a nice question to ask, and it's like it makes my soul come to life, you know, because when I started Compassion Works, that was what it was all about. And the kids were young, and I thought, okay, I want to teach them how to be give back. And they were like, oh my gosh, mom. Well, you know, and I tried. But the good thing is now, you know, flash forward all these years, they totally get it. And they are. They just needed to, you know, I thought, well, these would be tools that could help a child like go from high school into college and show them all the, you know, community service work, genuine community service work, and target it. Like, I don't care about feeding the world, but I care about the oceans, or I care about, you know, like, marry your passion with compassion. That is what I have said to every person who will ever listen to me. So pick what you love. Like, I love motorcycles. So I was like, I'm going to go learn about the motorcycle riders who are nurses and medical providers in Africa. And they take their motorcycles into these remote villages. They're basically glorified mechanics because when the bike breaks down, they better fix it so they can get on their way to go, you know, help the people in the villages. And all sorts of initiatives like that, where it's like, yeah, you marry your compassion with your passion, and you try and just stick to what you love, because you may not love weeding at an old folks' home, but you may love filming. So if you film somebody who does love weeding at the old folks' home, then you're creating that content for that person to use that towards, you know, showing that they want to be in that space, you know, down the road or whatever. But if you're filming and you're contributing and that's your passion, pick up the camera and run, and continue to use that tool. I mean, that's the greatest, to me, the kids are the greatest place to look. And I don't think you know, beating them over the head with, like, I mean, I was a little bit tough on, you know, I was like trying to do all this. But now, then I realized it's just like, just do it and don't talk about doing it, just do it. And so now the kids are like, Mom, where are you? And they track me on their phones, which I didn't really know. So I'm like, I'm okay. But they are, you know, they're the first to help out. I mean, I see it, and I don't see it when I'm looking. I see it out of the side, you know, the side glance. And you see them do something, but kids are amazing that way. Before they maybe, I don't know, before they get caught up in other things or other directions, I urge them to just keep your eyes open and just remember, you know, even a smile, like somebody. And that I learned in the craziest time. Like, there we were in the Ukraine, and we were on the border, and we went there because some of our deported, some of our, sorry, in Chicago with Rags of Honor and Veteran Roasters, two of the companies we founded, hiring homeless, at-risk veterans. A couple of the guys were like, "We can do something. We've got gear." And then some medics, some other veterans who were medics, came forward and said, "We really want to bring medical supplies and equipment, and body armor, whatever we can get our hand, food, formula, baby diapers, whatever. We can do this. Maybe we could, can you help us?" And so it was like day four of that all going down. And we thought, well, we could put some pallets together, we could stage it at Rags of Honor, we could put it all together here, and then we could ship it. I'm like, great, maybe it arrives, maybe it doesn't, maybe it happens in months. What about right now? So then we did the math, and we realized that I think it was Polish Airway or something, they would let us have per individual could carry 11 of the big duffel bags, the sea bags. So I was like, okay, let's go. So we were about six, and Jimmy, who's like 18 feet tall, Jimmy does all our designs for the t-shirts. Jimmy's like, come on, I can carry like 12 more. And I mean, this amazing lean into it attitude, again, from somebody who has had, had fallen on hard times, but this gave them a mission, it gave them purpose, and it was go time. So again, you step back and you let them own that. It is not about, like, I'm like, hey, we'll figure it out. And so that's what Mark and I did. We figured it out and let them kind of stage it. And then we found the group that got us Help Heroes of Ukraine. They picked up the gear that we then shipped later. But the 11 duffel bags per person, the entire police department of Chicago, like, gave us this 20 car, I mean, it must have been, what do you call it, escort. And off we went to the airport, and we had a mountain of gear because these guys said, we gotta go, we gotta help.
The tie to passion and compassion, is that's what that advice is, tying those two together. And I think there's a sense of where you may not be able to see how you're going to get to the goal, but you don't give up on the goal just because you don't see how it all is shakes out, right? Because other people can come in and help, and other people step up in ways when you have these kind of big and audacious, bold goals and missions that you want to achieve. And they may not get all the way there, but even if they get halfway there, it's a whole lot better than nothing, right?
Yeah, we definitely saw it. We got there. We got, these guys were extraordinary, and there was a lot going on at this refugee sort of encampment. We were greeting all these buses all night long. The buses kept coming with with these poor people who were yesterday just like us, and then all of a sudden they have in a, shopping bag their whole life. And it was the kindness of back to, just compassion, but also the just kindness of a smile. It was the middle of the night, and it was, oh my gosh, she must have been like 85, this woman. These blue eyes like I've never seen before. And she came down the stairs barely off the bus. And I just remember, like, I don't know what happened, but it was like, either I knew this woman before somewhere in my worlds or whatever, but I just went to her, and there was this embrace, not a word, because I don't speak Ukrainian, but we just had this moment, and it was just, she like put her hand on my face and just, and I smiled, and she just, you could tell that was all like just showing up, right? So anyway, she reminded me of that, because you never know, like, just the slightest thing. So,
Less
and
is, yeah, go ahead, go ahead.
well, anyway, for Hector and his incredible efforts to help these individuals, these people, I mean, it's just showing up is, and balancing that, for him, I see it, the how it doesn't, it can't take everything, you've got to fill that back up. And I worry about the balance, because it is heavy, and you have to offset it. So he's, working on mindfulness, and I'm really like honored to be able to work with these people, to work with these men and women, and and get to meet their families, and they're just so gracious and so generous of spirit, of everything they have. And I just wish I could bottle it and like spread it around a little bit. Like that
Yeah.
is the, you find it in the most extraordinary places.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Last question as we wrap up here today. And we'll have another time to dive
Oh,
into some more stuff. This is
thank you.
beautiful.
Thank you.
What you know, you've I mean, obviously, as someone listens to this, we can hear all sorts of instances of courage and all sorts of instances of ways that you and others have been brave and acted that way. And so my last question is really around, kind of what are your thoughts about thriving, and what do you, I mean, I'm not, I don't want to, I see lots of it in you, but what would you say to be thriving is, and the people that you've engaged with and the people that you help and kind of cross that whole span. How do you define that?
What, it's a great, what a wonderful word, by the way. And I'm really very, very impressed with that. That's like a, they're pillar words that are really critical, like compassion, teachability, willingness, humility, kindness, respect. But thriving is a word, it's an active word. And I love that. And that's, I think that is, I think in the question is the answer, right? To thrive is to be active, to be actively engaged in something. I'm gonna knit sweaters for the penguins in the Antarctic or whatever, like actively doing something. I mean, I've heard these stories, and again, it's marrying your passion with compassion, right? So thriving is, you absorb a lot, but you also, you kind of, you're leaning into it, and you're just in a world as completely, and I don't want to get into it, crazy as what we have going on in today's world. And I mean, up against a tsunami of people afraid to do anything and are normalizing everything, what can, I just want to, I face, we all face this every single minute. Well, there's nothing I can do. Nothing I can do. I'm gonna go, I don't know, drink a beer and kick back on my front porch or whatever people are doing. I don't know. But to me, the only way through is to pick a lane, pick a project, pick something you can do something about. Like, I don't know, go serve at the soup kitchen, because man, it's $7 a gallon of gas out here in San Diego, and and people are hurting. There is food instability. You don't have to look far, like at all. So that is, thriving is just being curious. Curiosity is perhaps the most important word on the planet Earth. Curiosity, if you look, you will find. But if you don't look, look up from your screens and give a peek out over the horizon a little bit, and I think you'll see. And my favorite quote of all is Einstein's, nothing happens till something moves. And so that was always my attitude, is, and again, thriving is movement, is It's the act of doing something
That's
and
great.
settling into it, right?
Well, thanks so much, and thank you for
Thank
your
you.
time. This is so wonderful, and I think we've covered so much ground, and but in covering all these stories that you're telling, there's some deep themes that are in there, and I appreciate you, Kip, you sharing them. I really do.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob. Thank you from so many years ago and all the way up to today. And who knows? I think we just keep going. We keep trying. Give it our best shot.
All right,
Beautiful.
Hope.
All right. Thank you all so much. Wow, Kip. Wow. I have a million ideas about how to help you spread that word from a incandescent PR perspective because we must give you a giant megaphone and you have such a giant heart,
Oh,
right?
thank you. Thank you so much, you guys.
Thank you. Yes. So thank you. I mean, I love that you guys were high school friends. That's incredible. From then till now, you never know what magic will is afoot. And there is a lot for both of you. So you are listening to, and watching Courage to Thrive, Reverend Dr. Bob Flanagan show on the Incandescent Radio Network and Incandescent TV. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer, very proud producer of the show. And you can also follow us on Spotify, Apple, and iHeart. And if you go to tinyurl.com/ Father Bob TV, you'll find us quickly on YouTube because the show is also a video. So please join us again for next month's episode. Thank you, Kip. Best, best, best of luck to
Thank
you.
you.
And thank you, Bob, for another amazing
As
episode.
always.
All right,
Thank
y'all. We'll
you.
see you
Bye.
soon. Keep
Okay. Take
the
care.